Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming to this public lecture on the challenges facing the prevention and treatment of obesity to be given by Professor Ian Caterson. My name is Joe Proietto. I'm a professor of medicine at this university. This lecture culminates today's day-long launch of the University of Melbourne Obesity Consortium. This consortium brings together over 80 people in 40 different groups, all linked in some way to the University of Melbourne, that have an interest in studying and preventing or treating obesity. We know what a scourge obesity is on society because it causes so much illness and misery. In fact, obesity is such an intractable and serious problem that various groups within the Victoria have banded together to form the University of the Victorian Obesity Consortium, and this involves three universities: Melbourne, Monash, and Deakin, and two institutes: the Baker Idi and the Murdoch Institute. We've all got together to establish this Victoria-wide entity. This will be launched in September. It is a great pleasure for me to introduce Professor Ian Caterson to you. I've known Ian for many years. Ian is Bowden Professor of Human Nutrition at the University of Sydney and Director of the Institute of Obesity, Nutrition and Exercise. Previously, he was Senior Staff Specialist and Director of Clinical Endocrinology at the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital. He undertook his postdoctoral studies at Oxford University. His research interests have included insulin resistance and the causes, prevention and treatment of obesity. He is a past president of both the Australian Diabetes Society and the Australasian Society for the Study of Obesity. He is currently on the management committee of the International Obesity Task Force and is a regional advisor on obesity for the World Health Organization. He is regional vice president for Asia Oceania for the International Association for the Study of Obesity. He was co-chair of the highly successful 10th International Congress of Obesity that was held in Sydney in 2006. Tonight, Professor Caterson will talk to us on challenges facing prevention and treatment of obesity. He will then chair the question and answer session. Ian.
Thank you very much for inviting me to what has been a fascinating day, and I've learned a lot. I'm going to talk briefly, I hope, even though I have lots of slides, and then I'm going to make people from here answer questions. Now, Joe said I was going to talk on the challenges, but I'm going to talk on the W's and the H's of obesity and try and get you thinking about it. Now, the first W about obesity that we have to think about is who. Who has obesity? Who gets obesity? And the simple answer is almost everybody in Australia, if you want to look at it. And if you look at this slide, which just shows from 1980 to 2000 plus, in females and in males, overweight and obesity's gone up, just so that in we males, it's the norm. Two-thirds about of men are overweight or obese, and about half women. But as you can see, there has been an increase, particularly in the 80s and the 90s. And so we've actually changed. That from a family immediately post-war to a family now. Now, in part, this is due to our genes, right? That we are predisposed to becoming overweight and obese, given the right circumstances. And we've certainly got the right circumstances now. What about our kids? Well, this is something we've done in New South Wales, and we're going to do again next year, because certainly the boys are going up, And it starts at a fairly low level of overweight and obesity, you know, about 10%, 1 in 10. Now it's about 1 in 4. Maybe the girls are flattening off. So the next one will really be interesting to see. In Japan, 12-year-old schoolgirls are not getting any fatter, and Japanese women are getting thinner. So it's not perhaps everybody. And I like to show this slide because it just shows around the world children increasing in obesity. And the reason I particularly like to show this slide is that one single dot up there. That's New Zealand in 2002. So I can, I'm always rude about the New Zealanders because we play them at rugby. And they've been beating us recently, so we're not allowed to. But here, they're certainly beating us as well. We are still doing fairly well. So really, when you look at Australia over the last 100 years, we've certainly made a lot of progress. And there certainly have been changes, and perhaps we've got to start changing our image of ourselves. So the second W, first is who? Almost everybody. Why? Well, we are who we are. We've got our genes, but there have been subtle changes in eating and activity and in our environment. Our genes haven't changed. We're more affluent. We've altered our food and we do less. And do you, I want to show you some figures. This is the only figures we have in Australia. In Australia, we actually don't measure very much, but we're trying terribly hard to get things looked at. But this is figures between 1983 and 1995. Now, over that time, we were saying to people, eat less fat. You're getting a bit fatter. You need to eat less. And when you look at what the Australian males, and this is in kilojoules, so you divide it by about 4 for calories, they're saying they ate 10,000 kilojoules, 10,800 in 1983, they're eating about 400 kilojoules. That's 100 calories a day more in 1995. They'd been very good. They'd dropped their fat by 6 grams a day, but they'd pushed up their carbohydrate, and they tell us that they'd reduce their alcohol. If I asked you all what you ate in the last 24 hours, you would lie to me, right? We call it under-reporting, right? Not just you, right? Everyone. And overall, it's about 25%. So people are eating a lot more than they think. This is adults, males and females. I like to say men admit to eating 100 grams of fat a day. So you add the 25%. Now think of those margarine containers you buy, 250 grams. Men are eating half of one of those every day. Women are not much better off. They're eating about 100 grams of it. And part of it, and this comes from National Geographic, this is American, is that we've been upsizing. So that in the 50s and 60s, things were small. Coca-Cola came in a smallish bottle with 79 calories, and now you're up to 194 calories in your average bottle. If you eat popcorn at the movies and you buy the large bucket, that's almost your day's calories in the bucket. The other thing is we're not doing as much. And this comes from a study where they got students to eat as much as they liked but exercise for an hour a day. But they manipulated the amount of fat they were getting. And if you are of low activity, when you got above about 25% of fat in your diet, and we all eat about 30, you went into positive energy balance. You couldn't help it. But if you did 1 hour of activity a day, you could reduce that. And you could eat up to 54% of fat without gaining weight. What about our kids? We're really good about our kids, aren't we? We tell them what to eat. We give them in their lunch boxes. What's happened to our kids between the same time? Well, at every age group, and I can show you this is at 4, 6, 8, and I can show you right up to 16, at every age group, our kids are eating between 15 and 25% more in the 1990s and even more in the 2000s than they did in the 80s. And what makes up this difference? What makes up this difference? Lance? No, it's discretionary foods. It's the little treats we put in. Soft drinks, fruit, muesli bars, rather than food. So why are kids getting fat? We're feeding them 15 to 25% more. The other thing is, why are we getting fat? This is Sydney from a while ago, but most of us now come to work by car. They're trying to make us come to work by bike. I actually walk, and I'm still having trouble with my weight. But that's another reason. And what's happening to our school kids? Well, down. This is girls and boys walking or cycling to school over a 10-year period, and it's now very few of them come by push bike. But they're watching television. So if you look at this, these are kids in primary and secondary school watching less than 2 hours a day, small screen recreation. There are some kids who watch 4 to 6 hours a day. And there are some kids who even do more than 6 hours a day. And the proportion here is about 15 to 20% of our children are watching 4 to 6 hours small screen recreation a day. I haven't got time to go into this, but also you can blame your mother. Not just for the genes she gave her, but for the size you were when you're born. And we know that if you were a small birth weight baby, when you grow up, you get all those metabolic diseases, diabetes, blood pressure, heart trouble. Much more likely. But also, as we're seeing now more and more bigger babies, as mums are well fed, these babies go on to be obese kids. So whatever it is, there's a nice medium where we should be in birth weight. Let's be real. Why has it happened? Well, they went out to look and find out why it happened. And the reason is that people with lower income tend to put on weight, but 68% of the cause, when the economists looked after, was due to the increased number of food outlets. That's restaurants, supermarkets, fast food joints. With the more of those, there was a reduction in price, so people ate more. And then we as doctors in the medical profession have done our bit too. We put up the cost of cigarettes and brought in clean air laws. So what does that mean? People have more money and they eat more food. And for mothers who work, for every 10 hours increase in the hours worked by the mother, there's a 2.5% increase in the obesity in their kids. All right, who, why worry? Most of us are like it. Well, disease and cost. These are the usual diseases. Really high type 2 diabetes, heart disease, cancer, osteoarthritis costs a lot. You see this hole up here? That's where cancer used to be. As we are getting fatter, our risk of cancer due to obesity, certain cancers, is increasing, and it's moving up quite rapidly. And what we've got to think is we're not just dealing with obesity or overweight, but we're dealing with the family. They all look the same, but they're all different. There are the diabetes, there's the heart disease, there's the blood pressure, there's the high fats and lipids in the blood, or there's the combination. Or I could add sleep apnea, or I could add to them. They all look the same and they're all the same problem, come from the same problem. And AusDiab has worked out, because of this, we have 1,000 new cases of diabetes each year. 100,000, I'm sorry. 200,000 more people become obese. 400,000 get blood pressure. And 470,000 get some form of kidney damage. So as we get obese, we're really causing problems. It causes obesity. It's not the sole cause, but it is a major cost in all those diseases. How about our kids? Kids are healthy. Well, these are 15-year-olds, and as their body mass index, which is the way we measure obesity, goes up, the percentiles, just in the growth chart, so the number of those risk factors, blood pressure, lipids, abnormal glucose, fatty liver, increases. By the age of 15, 11% had three or more of these risk factors for cardiac disease. Now, they've talked about the cost. The figures are in between 2006 and 2008 in Australia, the health system cost went up, more than doubled. The carer costs, that people looking after people who have obesity, went up. The tax loss wasn't too bad. What the government is worried about is the productivity loss with people with days off. And people who are overweight and obese feel terrible. You know, don't feel quite right, which I couldn't say terrible, but they've got a bit of arthritis, they've got aches and pains. They don't feel themselves, they don't have their own self-esteem. So they can quantify that. So it does cost a lot. And who bears it in this country? Mostly by the family. The Commonwealth government, through Medicare, pays a bit. State governments don't pay anything. Employers pay nothing. And the rest of society, in some way, pays for those costs. So when you look at obesity, now this is thinking, what causes disease in Australia? We know we shouldn't smoke. And in men, smoking causes about 12 and a half disability adjusted life years. That's years of being sick or dying early. What's the biggest risk in women? Physical inactivity, causing 7 or so. This is blood pressure, alcohol harm and benefit, overweight and obesity, which they halved, lack of fruit and vegetables. If you add up lack of fruit and vegetables, overweight and obesity, and physical activity, all the things that are intertwined, it's by far the biggest risk for Australian society. Is it just fat? Another W. What fat? Where and why? And it's the fat around your waist. Now, these pictures came from a friend of mine in Japan who runs a clinic for sumo wrestlers. Now, while they're fighting sumo wrestlers, they're pretty good. They get, you know, the usual contact injuries from sport, but they're healthy. But within 1 year of stopping, despite getting dietary advice and exercise advice, 35% of them get diabetes, and many die in their early 40s with heart disease. Why? Well, it's where your fat is. So if you'd all pinch your fat, please. All hold your fat. Good. Now, all that fat that you can feel, you ate. It came in through your mouth, because normally we human beings, except if we're recovering from severe illness, don't make fat. We eat the carbohydrate, we burn up the carbohydrate, or alcohol, first of all. We burn the alcohol we drink, because we can't store it. We burn the carbohydrate and protein we eat, and that's mostly our day's requirements. And what's left? Fat. And where does it go? Now, this is a cut through sumo wrestlers. And here's a fighting sumo wrestler. So you can see his backbone, reasonably thick muscles, his belly button. And where is his fat? It's all under the skin and not around deeper in the intestine. When he stops fighting, where does it go? Centrally. So what? It's that deep fat around your intestines that causes the problems. And we know that the adipocytes there produce a whole range of things, some hormones, some cytokines that are damage, some other things that cause inflammation and cause disease. So fat isn't fat. It just doesn't sit there and do nothing, as we used to think. It actually is very active and it is very damaging, particularly the fat around here. Do you know how to measure your waste? Do you know the Commonwealth Government's sending out its waste measure at the moment? How do you measure your waste? They're all sitting quietly. Measuring your waist is not your waist. It's midway between your ribs and the upper border of your hips in horizontally. So it's really up a bit higher than the narrowest bit. And it's not your belly button either, right? And the other thing about measuring your waist, it's not when you're breathing in, it's when you're breathing out to give yourself maximum problem. Now, what we do at the moment, we know obesity causes problems, and we're up at this end, we're treating the diseases. We're trying to treat a bit earlier, and really what we should be doing is either treating the underlying problem, or even better, being down here, preventing it. So what can we do and what to expect? Lose a little weight and be active. Oh, wrong button. This is one of our clinics. We took the people from who treated people with diabetes in the diabetes centre, and they used to say, can't get anyone to lose weight, can't get them to do any better. So we moved them across the road on a Tuesday and said, you're not the diabetes centre anymore, you're the metabolic rehabilitation clinic. And we said, there's a gym, and made people to come. Same staff. And we shifted the patients, they said, oh, I'll never do anything, across to the metabolic rehabilitation clinic. For our first they did sit around a bit of the time well over there. But for our 12-month results, we've got 70 out of the 100 patients. We've got the two-year results, which are a little bit worse. These people lost 10 kilograms, their waist came down, their diabetes got better, their blood pressure got better, the fats in their blood got better. And the only thing we did different was to say to them, eat a little bit less, which we checked, and we said to them, you have to come to our gym 3 times a week. And they lost weight. It's being and the same staff. They were enthusiastic and did things. You can do it in kids too, and we heard about this a bit today. This is another program, it's a parenting program. And this is a funny way of doing it, but over time, their Z scores came down and they've stayed down, which is good. So how are you going to do it? How are we going to do things? Well, most of this is familiar to us: eating, activity, habit, maybe medical, maybe drugs, and follow-up. The important thing, this is using a drug to treat obesity, but if you add lifestyle, you get much better results. So there's no single answer, right? It's a combination of all those things I mentioned. Some people, it'll be more of one, less of the other, and other people it will be it's individual. What's important about diets? Now, I'm often asked this. The most important thing about diet comes from this slide. So I tried a number of diets, and you can see on each diet there was a range of weight loss. But when they asked people how easy was it to stick to it, the higher the I can stick to it score, the better they did. So when you go back to diets, what's important? Eat smaller portions. Start from where you are. Don't try and change things dramatically, right? So it's no good telling my brother-in-law, who's a grazier in Queensland, he's got to just become a vegetarian and eat low GI food, he'll laugh at me. Similarly, for one of my elderly Chinese ladies, it's no good telling them eat high protein because they won't. So you start where you are and you make small changes. Maybe a little bit more protein because that's filling. Reduce the bad fats, the saturated fats. Cut the fat off your meat. More fiber. Try and use fresh food, stuff that you like and is convenient. And then you've got to think, I've lost my weight. How do I keep it off? What's going to keep me going? And there again, a whole range of things. You could, and this is this bit, if you're a 60 to 70 kilo lady, you can do, have to do 18,000 steps to burn. Or you could be, think, you could design the environment a bit and make it necessary for you to... Exercise will help you lose weight. So they made these women exercise 90 minutes a day and they lost 4 kilograms. They changed their diet to 28% fat and they lost 11 kilograms. So in any way of losing weight, exercise will be about 1/3 and a change in your eating will be about 2/3. It's important to remember that. It's not just one thing, it's the two together. You can have surgery. It's in the news all the time. The one we use is banding. And certainly that does bring your weight down, you know, 30 kilograms or 15 to 30 kilograms. But this is the study I like. This is from Taiwan. Now, you wouldn't think they had an obesity problem, would you, in Taiwan? But their average BMI was 43 when they did. That's quite big. That's in the grade 3 obesity. In 12 months, they lost, having this lap band surgery, they lost 38 kilograms. And of those who had disease, there was a 96% cure. That meant they were off all medications at the end of that year. So for very big people, thinking surgery after going through a medical, lifestyle plus medical program is worthwhile considering. So you can lose a lot by surgery, but how much can most of us do? Just a little. And I wanted to talk to you about, finally, this is general practice in England. And what they did was everyone who came into the general practice in England, if they are overweight, the practice nurse said to them, look, you're a little bit overweight, do you want to do something about it? And if they said yes, they gave them a little bit of advice. A little bit more activity, a little bit less eating. Very general. And every time they came back, they weighed them. And at the those who didn't come very often lost at the end of 2 years 1 kilogram. Those who came a bit more lost 3 kilograms. Did that make a difference? Well, at the end of 2 years, the cost of drugs they were taking, that went down in men by about 9% and women by 7%, just with that 3 kilograms, which if you're a health doctor, you think is wonderful. In Britain, it saved them £1.55 billion, 3 kilogram weight loss. For you, if you're overweight or obese and on tablets, it might mean you're not on some. But prevention. It's better than cure. You can prevent diabetes, and this is in 4 countries, by just a little bit of weight loss. In Finland, they said, little bit of weight loss, less fat, less saturated fat, the bad fat, more fiber, and 30 minutes of activity a day. They reduced, this was in people who were at high risk of diabetes, they reduced the risk of the amount of diabetes in those people by 58%. If you reached 4 or 5 of those goals, you didn't get diabetes. The older, the better. And they went back 7 years later, and there was still a benefit, even though it was only a small weight loss. So for how long, this is the last state, do I have to do it? I have to look after my weight for life. There's no magic if I've got the tendency to put weight on. There's no magic way that's going to get rid of it for me. There are ways of helping, because we know that those who are more physically active can keep their weight off longer. So here are a group of people who lost weight, and the most active people keep it off. It's quite a lot. You've got to do an hour or more of activity a day. So if you lost weight and want to keep it off, what do you have to do? An hour or so of activity. That's walking or something a day, not 30 minutes. Low diet, low in fat, in smaller portions. You've got to eat breakfast. You've got to monitor what you're doing so you know when you catch a slip and say, oh, I'm slipping up. I've got to go back and do something. And they're the people who keep weight off. Now, the final H is, up to now, it's you, your family, the doctor. The final H is, how can the government help? It can do something. It's not doing anything. This is the real map about the problem of obesity. And it gets more and more complicated. So here's the poor people who are overweight and obese. It's due to what you don't, your energy expenditure and your food intake. That's influenced by work, school and home. That's influenced by your where you live, your community. That's influenced by the country you live in and whether you live in the outback. And then there are international factors like food, big food companies, development, media programs and advertising. And so where can the government intervene? Well, it's difficult down here. It can intervene here and in this bit, right? It can make food transport cheaper so the country gets better food. It can help with the health system. It can think about education. So here we all are trying to be healthy, right? We're eating healthily, we're being as active as we can, and we're trying to keep a healthy weight. So it's easier for us to be a healthy eater, do enough activity, and keep our weight as healthy as possible, and helps us to change behaviour. So this is some things the government can do, but I'm not going to talk about them now. Okay, thank you very much. I'm sorry to have kept you so long. Come and we'll sit down. We have a panel of experts from around Melbourne, and I get to be rude and ask questions. And what I'm going to do, come and sit down. Now, from the far end, I'm going to ask you to introduce yourself, name and one sentence to describe what you do.
So I'm Matt Sabin, I'm a paediatrician at the Children's Hospital and Murdoch Children's Research Institute, where we have a large clinical service delivery for obese children and a lot of clinical research.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. Ahmed Ali is my name. I'm a general and upper GI surgeon, so weight loss surgery is part of what I do at the Austin Hospital in Melbourne.
I'm Joe Proietto. I'm a physician. I run the obesity clinic at the Austin Hospital, but we also, in my lab, research the causes of obesity and its complications.
I'm Cameron Johnson. I'm a dietitian, work at Austin Health, and I work with the bariatric clinic and also the weight control clinics at Austin Health.
I'm Jo Williams, and I'm an epidemiologist at the Centre for Adolescent Health within the Murdoch Children's Research Institute, and we do a lot of basically population health research into obesity, particularly focusing on children and adolescents.
I'm Mark Hargraves from the Department of Physiology and the School of Medicine, and we're interested in studying the effects of exercise on muscle and fat.
And I'm Naomi Crafty. I'm a psychologist and I'm Community Development Education Officer at the Eating Disorders Foundation of Victoria. And I like to go around and talk to people about mental health and obesity issues.
All right. Now, has anyone got a burning question? Because while you're thinking of your questions, I'm going to ask the panel one or two just to get themselves started. Now, I showed pictures about lap band surgery producing 30 kilograms weight loss versus
5 to 10 kilogram weight loss. Is lap band surgery the best form of surgery to combat obesity?
That's a good question, because it really depends on which surgeon you ask.
What do you think? Come on.
Well, I think when you look at any surgical procedure, you have to look at two sides of the equation. And one is the outcomes. Does it achieve what you want to achieve? And the other is, if you like, the risks involved, or the cost for those outcomes. And when you put it on that balance, I think, yes, laparoscopic gastric banding is probably the most suitable procedure and the best procedure in general.
For all of us, all we overweight individuals?
Well, surgery has its own role in treating obesity, and it is treating obesity, not just overweight, and I won't go into those definitions, but we are really looking at those people who are very heavy. We're not talking about 5 or 10 kilos overweight.
Now, from the Murdoch Children's Hospital, there's at the end, children, right? I've been having real troubles with my eldest son. While he's playing sport in the winter, his weight is good, but as soon as he stops playing sport, his weight goes up, and really I can't get him to eat vegetables or fruit. If he's overweight or obese now, does that mean he's going to be overweight or obese when he's adult?
Yeah, so if you're overweight or obese as a child, then there is an association with a tight association with being obese or overweight as an adult. But if you're obese or overweight as a child, you also have independent health risk factors, and those are particularly around cardiovascular risk and propensity towards diabetes, developing diabetes in an earlier stage. So actually, it's really key to get in as early as you can. And you don't need to get in early with interventions that in the majority of cases are too severe, such as very low calorie diets or lap banding or anything like that. It's just about sensible choices. And sensible choices work well, especially in younger children, where parents are able to make some more empowering decisions. So I'd be thinking for your son that what the critical thing is that obviously his weight is fine when he's playing football, but there's a time in the year when actually football's not around, and that's the time that's difficult. And so really it comes down to finding opportunities for physical activity that he enjoys. And that's the crucial thing, actually, is to find things that are easily put into into a child's lifestyle that are sensible and balanced, and that they can easily do without making too much of an impact. And so those things come down to sensible choices about eating, routine meal times, finding snacks that are not particularly energy dense if at times they want to eat, and finding sensible patterns of physical activity with things that they enjoy doing. It doesn't matter what it is. It can be jumping, trampolining, dancing, singing, whatever, as long as it's an enjoyable form of physical activity.
Questions? Anyone got any questions that they... Yes.
Cameron. I think that's a great point that the author did make, that to say that eat when you're hungry, because one of the things that we're inclined to do is eat lunch at 12 o'clock, not because we're hungry, but because it's lunchtime, or to have a snack at afternoon tea because you're having a coffee break. And that's one of the things that we are disinclined to eat when it's time to eat, whether we're hungry or not. One of the issues that could come up with only eating when you're hungry is that if you've gone a long time, and by a long time I mean like from the night before and you're eating dinner, you may be inclined to eat large amounts. And as well as eating large amounts, you may be more inclined to eat inappropriate food choices in the case that you're really hungry. So if you're really hungry, you may go for chocolate bars or hamburgers just to feel that craving that you'll have at that moment. So it's not necessarily to say that you should eat every 2 hours or anything like that, but to eat when you're hungry is good, but just to ensure that the choices that you make at the times that you do eat are also appropriate.
Okay. Can I ask a question first? Naomi, I've got one here from people. Are eating disorders and obesity linked?
I think so. At Eating Disorders Victoria, we have the position that eating disorders and obesity are two sides of the same coin. In 1994, I was at a conference in London, and it was the first time that experts in the obesity field were there together with experts in the eating disorder area. And it was a very promising time for me and for other researchers working in that area, because we felt that finally people were going to look at the two sides of the coin simultaneously. We're now 15 years down the track, and I don't really think that's happened to any great extent. We all know here that we do tend to work in silos somewhat. But we think that eating disorders and obesity are two sides of the same coin, because we think that many of the factors that have caused an increase in the in obesity in our society have also caused an increase in the incidence of eating disorders. And that is things like psychological factors together with emphasis on the thin ideal, and people engaging in excessive dieting practices and inappropriate eating behaviours to try and reach an ideal weight that is not achievable for most people.
Thank you. You had a question up the back, yes?
There's been some state and federal legislation passed to restrict smoking, restrict alcohol consumption, some of which has been successful. Do you see legislation that might be effective in decreasing obesity?
Joe? Mark?
It's difficult to think what that legislation might be. I mean, one obvious thing might be banning advertising of junk food to children, and I think I can't see any downside to that, except in terms of profits for certain companies. So that would be useful to trial. There's no guarantee that that would work, however. We're not sure. It would need a study done in, say, one state. Other legislation is difficult. We could legislate for the removal of harmful fats, but we can't legislate to reduce the food availability in our society, nor can we legislate to force people to do physical activity. We can build bike paths, but then it's up to the individual to use them. So it's... apart from a few areas, I think at this point it's difficult to see where legislation might really be helpful.
Mark? Would you like to make that?
No, I don't know.
Lance?
Well, government regulates our gambling habits by controlling the number of gambling centres that are out there. Is there a role for it in perhaps restricting the number of fast food
Before you answer, I showed a slide that said that 68% of the variance in cause of obesity was due to the number of food outlets, which is restaurants, fast food outlets, supermarkets in any area. would there be legislation in town planning to legislate the number of these in any area? Do you think that would help?
On the surface, you'd think that it might. However, and I know rats are rats and people are bigger rats, but there is evidence that from at least one rat study in which you make a rat obese who's susceptible with a high-fat diet, if you then get it to go on a diet by not putting food in the cage and get him to lose weight, and then simply expose him to healthy food, very low-fat chow, those rats become obese again on the healthy food. So if we can extrapolate, and that's a big if, I accept that, if we can extrapolate to humans, it would suggest that if we get rid of McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken, we may perhaps prevent obesity in the next generation. But my personal guess would be that would make very little difference to the obese people who are already obese.
Thank you. I can make one suggestion that I think would help in legislation. It's in transport policy, which I think that one of our problems in Australia is that so a can of soft drink costs $2 in the city and it costs $2 in Alice Springs. An apple costs $1 in the city and $3 in Alice Springs. If we had a transport policy or a subsidy that allowed the transport of fresh food quickly so that the price came down, because we know cutting prices increases sales. So that would be, to my mind, a simple one that could be done. Mark, you've been sitting there too quietly. How much exercise is enough?
I think it goes to the point that was made earlier. The epidemiology would suggest that all-cause mortality is reduced around the levels of the National Physical Activity Guidelines, which is why they were put at that level, about 30 minutes of activity on every day if possible, and more is better. If you want to prevent significant weight gain, you need to do a bit more in the order that Ian mentioned. But there are benefits that accrue from those smaller amounts of exercise that don't necessarily impact on body mass. So there are effects on the cardiovascular system, effects on the metabolism of sugars and fats. And there may well be a slight weight gain over time, but there are benefits derived from being physically active. So I think the current physical activity guidelines from a public health perspective are entirely appropriate because there are measurable benefits at that level. For any individual, obviously, if you do a bit more, and particularly if you do things a bit more intensely, there's good evidence that they can provide additional benefits.
Joe, before I ask that again, Joe Wynn, is TV to blame for the obesity epidemic, or are there some suburbs where it's worse than others?
Well, there's no doubt that there's very strong evidence that the hours of television watching is associated with overweight and obesity in children. There's been studies from various countries around the world that have, supported that. And it does vary. We do see variation across socioeconomic gradients with obesity, where those in the lower socioeconomic areas, we have higher overweight and obesity rates in not only children, in all age groups. And so, it's whether it's just television viewing or sedentary behaviour specifically. You showed very nice slides on small screen, and that takes in computer games and all of those things that all people often don't count when they're thinking of just television.
Are there any suburbs where it's worse than others? Not television watching, because, in my suburb of Camperdown with my son's lying in front of the door of the farm, there.
Well, there's huge community variation in overweight and obesity, and it isn't all explained by socioeconomic status. But there is huge community variation, so there is work that can be done at the local level to improve that.
One, two. Yes.
How important is it that obesity should be looked at as a family problem rather than an individual problem, particularly in regards to children?
So I can answer that. There's quite substantial evidence from Epstein's work, which has been going on for 20 or 30 years now in the States, showing quite conclusively that the best management, the best success at management of weight problems and control of weight in children is mediated by family change. And actually, I see that every single time that I talk to an obese child with their parents, is that actually if you can engage the family and you can make family changes, you're much more likely to get success. So I think it's integral, and certainly in the management of young children, we see it very much as the management of the family.
Anyone else like to comment?
I'd like to comment on that. The thing that we found in our research is that as a society, as we're getting heavier, people actually aren't even recognising that children are overweight, and therefore parents aren't going to intervene with a child that they don't even recognise is overweight or has a problem. And we actually find that the proportion of parents who don't recognise it increases as the child's weight increases. So that those, 70% of parents of overweight and obese children think they're normal weight. So they're not going to do anything about it. And I think that's a real problem, is that we're becoming desensitised to weight and that we're not recognising when a child actually is overweight.
I'd just like to balance those statistics by also pointing out, and as I said, they're not opposing statistics, it's the same problem, by pointing out that about 75% of women aged 18 to 22 who are of normal weight think that they need to lose weight. And they're desensitised to the fact that they are of normal weight because they're seeing in the media images of women that are tend to be underweight. So, it works at both ends of the spectrum.
Lance.
Can you show that this slide showing that obesity was becoming a bigger problem in the 20-year-old group?
Faster weight gain in the 25 to 35s, yeah.
And there's a move more and more to looking at younger and younger kids and where the development of this problem is occurring. And there's thoughts around the five-year-old age group, that sort of age group, and now even a lot more thought in pregnancy and neonatal. Where do you think we'll get the biggest bang for our buck in the research in prevention?
Joe, any first?
My own personal view is that the biggest bang for our buck, did I say that right? Because there is some evidence that genes can be silenced by environmental factors. The evidence of that happening within the uterus as the baby is developing is quite clear. It's not yet so clear about what we feed our children when they're very little, but there is some evidence that that's occurring then. So my view is that where we can achieve the most is to do research to identify what are called epigenetic triggers. If we can do that, then we can legislate them out of the food sources, if it turns out to be that there's only one or two. And I think that is our best hope, is to find epigenetic triggers, because something is triggering our children to become fat, and once fat, it seems to be a chronic condition.
Do you think there are
any
fuel these or these triggers? I mean, fructose is one thing that's...
Fructose, yeah. In
the sugar in soft
drink. When I'm feeling optimistic, I think there's only one or two. When I'm pessimistic, there's probably 100.
No, there's going to be 150.
So I would say...
And Ahmed, do you have an idea on this? You're a surgeon. You go first.
Okay. I'll add something to that. So we know that if you want to do well with the control of weight in childhood, the earlier you get in, the better. And we know that early nutrition is very important, and that early nutrition is probably important even in the womb. And so in order to improve nutrition and the environment in the womb, you really need to improve the health of the mum. And so in order to improve the health of the mum, the best way that you can do that is to get in early. And so then you're through back to childhood. And so it's almost just like a vicious circle. It's just ad so infinitum. And I think at some stage, I don't know that we'll ever know what you get the best bang for your buck, but at some stage we need to make efforts to change everything from childhood all the way through to healthy mums to try and get the best that we can do. That's what I would add.
Hamid, do you?
Well, you know, being involved in the surgical end isn't really prevention. It's really the end of the line in treatment, I guess. But my own observations and I guess the work that's been done in epidemiologically, and we've seen this rapid rise of obesity. We understand the environmental changes, we understand the food changes, we see that complex slide, which I think you presented, that's wonderful, going all the way back to international factors, show that whether we look at this as an individual thing or a family thing or a community environmental thing, it's all so enmeshed. It probably all has factors that contribute, and addressing it at early stages within the family, the individual, and at a society level is going to be important if we're looking at prevention. My concern is that much of it seems to be environmental, and whether that's affected the epigenetics or whether it's just a purely environmental effect is perhaps a moot point at the moment. How do we really change that environment significantly enough to make a major impact? Again, a bit like Joe, when I'm optimistic, I say to my patients, you know, obesity is not actually a surgical disease, even though we're going to talk about surgery. It's an environmental, genetic disease, a metabolic disease, whatever you like, but it's not a surgical disease as such. However, when I'm feeling pessimistic, I say, well, you know what, surgery is the only thing that seems to work in the long term, and this is why we need to do it. Preventative, I hope so, but I think it is a major environmental challenge.
A surgeon set up to deal with all the people they're going to be seeing for the rest of their life once they've done the surgery on them? Because surgery, in my mind, is you go in, you cut it out, and then you're cured and go away. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I think that's partly what I mean by this is not a surgical disease. You're right. If you've got gallstones, we take the gallbladder out, you feel better, and that's usually the end of it. This is not that sort of surgery at all. I think any surgeon that is involved in helping patients with obesity is really making a lifetime commitment to that patient and all of the patients that come through. The surgery is only one small factor in the treatment. It's actually a lifestyle change, it's an environmental change, it's a family change, it's all of those things. It's the psychology input that's important, it's behavioural change. The surgery, whether that be the band or a bypass or whatever else, is really just a tool that the patient uses to aid that. It helps control some of the physiology that perhaps Joe could elaborate on, and that gives the patient a really good head start, but it's not easy. It's certainly not a magic bullet, and it's certainly not an easy way out for the patient. They still have to make the right food choices. They still have to alter their behaviour. They still have to incorporate lifestyle change for success. It's just that the band makes it much easier for them to control some of the physiology that's going on that drives the obesity. And similarly for the surgeons and the teams that we work in, and it is a team effort, it is a major ongoing commitment. And the more patients one accumulates, the more difficult it is to manage. And that does pose real resource questions as well about the best way to approach this, even from a surgical point of view.
Cameron, do you agree?
Yeah, I do agree. And I'd just like to add that even if our patients do have surgery and they've had a restricted volume of food intake, I come into play in making sure that their food choices are nutritionally adequate, because that's something that's a bit of a paradox with our overweight patients, is that they've got so much nutrition that they're overweight, but the paradox is that they're often malnourished in that they're not meeting their micronutrient requirements. And the same with our bariatric surgery patients is, because they've got a smaller food intake, we need to make sure that they're getting adequate amounts of fibre, adequate amounts of vitamins, adequate amounts of minerals, adequate overall nutrition to meet their requirements to prevent chronic disease in the long term, but also to make sure that they're not having high calorie food. So we're not only looking at weight, but we're looking at nutrition adequacy for their long term health.
Mm-hmm. Right, questions? Any? Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, look, perhaps the easiest way is to convert that question into, does it work for everybody? And the answer is no, it doesn't. It has a very high success rate, over 80%, but it doesn't work in everybody. And some of the things that you've pointed out are some of the reasons it doesn't always work. One of the difficulties we have is predicting who's suitable, if you like, and I'm not talking now about who qualifies, I'm talking about actually who it's a good idea for. We actually still till now, despite quite a bit of research and don't really have a very clear way to predict who's going to do well and who isn't. No, there's no one single tool that helps predict. I mean, we tend to judge it from experience. We resource it through our team. You know, often the dietitians might get a different perspective to the surgeon or so on. So sometimes it's a group decision. And most of us working in those sort of teams are actually very careful about proceeding with surgery. We don't just offer it, you know, you've come to the clinic, we'll give you an operation. We do try to make sure, and I actually tell my patients, that I will talk to them about the surgery and the complications and the risks and so on, but actually that's not the important bit. The important bit is to work out whether you're really ready for this and make sure that they're well educated, they're well informed about what's involved, what commitment they're really taking on. The pleasing thing for us, I guess, is that many of these patients actually are. They don't walk into a surgical clinic for weight loss easily. It's at the end of a lifetime of struggling with their weight, of trying everything that they can possibly do, and they've really come at the end of the line. They're frustrated, they're fed up. This is, in their viewpoint, their last chance. And they've often come having researched it for quite a long time. Most of our patients will have thought about surgery for 12 months or more before they actually come seeking an opinion. So for most patients, you know, they're actually quite well informed and they've thought about it, and we can sense that they're ready, if you like. Despite that, we still spend quite a bit of time before surgery making sure of that. And yet we don't always pick it right, because people's behaviour is complex. The reasons that people overeat are complex. You don't always pick the emotional eating. You don't always have success in treating that. So,
is there a question up the back? No? Well, you can sit down. I'm going to talk about teenagers.
There's one over in
the corner. Yeah, then you. Can I talk about teenagers first? All right. Teenagers, very difficult. First of all, is teenage binge drinking linked to obesity?
We've basically seen binge drinking increasing alongside the obesity epidemic, and this is a very interesting topic because we haven't got much longitudinal research on this to say whether one has a causal relationship with the other or not. But there is absolutely no doubt that binge drinking is increasing, and in Australia we have alarming rates of very high alcohol use in underage teenagers. And even to the extent that 50% of students in year 8 have used alcohol in their life, and about 12% have had a binge in the last 2 weeks. So that's 5 or more drinks on one occasion. And so it's a massive problem that we do have with our adolescents, and it impacts not just on perhaps in the obesity area, but in all areas of health and well-being of adolescents, and it's a real concern.
All right, so I have a teenage daughter who is overweight or obese. I've tried everything. The three of you at this end, give me your views about what I should be doing next.
Who wants to go first?
Just some thinking music. Some thinking music for the others. Just anecdotally, at Eating Disorders Victoria, we're seeing young women now who are not eating because they know they're going to be binge drinking. So if they know they're going to be binge drinking in the evening, they're saying to themselves something like, I'm going to be having so many calories in my alcohol this evening, I won't have any breakfast, lunch or dinner, which you can imagine the impact that then has on the effect of the binge drinking. So, you know, it is a serious problem in many aspects of health. As far as the overweight teenager is concerned, again, from an eating disorders perspective, we would be very much emphasising health at any weight, which is a bit of a mantra that we use in the eating disorders area. So we wouldn't be focusing on the weight issues as much as focusing on health and what a person can do to as many people have talked about today and this evening, about maintaining a healthy diet and a healthy amount of exercise and let the weight look after itself, if you like, or settle at some level.
I'd encourage her to find an opportunity for physical activity that she enjoys, maybe mixed netball, and she might find an attractive young fellow to play netball with. Yeah. Or
isn't it called action ball?
Action ball, I don't know.
Well, I'm told it is action ball. Yeah. There's one less than a netball team and you're allowed to run further and it's mixed. Yes, very important. Yes, I've heard of that one.
Yeah. I absolutely agree with that. It's an issue that we have physical activity levels decline rapidly in teenage girls, and it's about finding an opportunity for physical activity where they're comfortable. Those that are comfortable in mixed teams, sometimes these sorts of sports rely on girls putting on, you know, fairly skimpy costumes, which they're not really happy to do in mixed company. And so perhaps, you know, for some teenage girls, it's about finding an opportunity in a women's gym or a session where there are only women to participate that would be ideal for her.
So I'm gonna exaggerate your question a bit more and say, okay, so say your 13-year-old girl's been having problems with her weight for some time. You've recognised it as a problem and she doesn't really recognise it as a problem and she doesn't really want to do anything about it and you've tried everything you possibly can. And you've taken her to the doctor and the doctor said, well, I don't really know what we can do, but we'll do some blood tests. And her, she's got a high cholesterol, she's got early diabetes, she's got high blood pressure. She doesn't want to do anything about her weight. You don't know what to do about your weight, about her weight, but you're bereft. Your doctor doesn't know what to do about her weight. Should we lap band her?
Yeah, I was going to say, my answer would be I'd send it to Joe and Ahmed and say,
should we be lap banding 13-year-olds who their weight to them is...
Let's even make it I'll make it a little easier, 15.
Okay.
Well, you said you'd send it to me and Joe, so Joe...
Look, I'm not sure how obese she is. Is she quite obese already?
Well, she's obese enough to feel uncomfortable about, you know, social situations, and the paediatrician I took her to has explained to me at length that she's right on the verge, or if not, getting metabolic disease.
Look, at this stage, I would encourage her very strongly to ignore her weight and just focus on getting fit. Really, that would be the very best thing for her. It would assist with her metabolic problems if she were to take up some sport. So I agree with Mark and with everybody else on the table that we should really focus on her fitness level rather than her weight. As she gets older, when she's in her early 20s, perhaps we can look at more vigorous ways if she still has a problem and still has a desire. She needs to have a desire. But without her consent, we might as well, we're wasting our time in trying to achieve weight loss. So once she has the desire, then we can help her. Initially with a more vigorous medical program, and then if that fails, perhaps then we can start thinking about surgery.
All right, she got me home after seeing you, and she says, Dad, I've tried everything. I want to go and talk to the surgeons. Do I take her to the surgeons?
I will address the surgical question. I guess one of the things I actually wanted to ask Matt on top of that is, this is a 13-year-old girl or a 15-year-old girl.
Her name's Harriet, by the way.
My experience of people often in general, even, you know, many of our adult patients that come to us for surgery, yes, they've got the diabetes, the metabolic syndrome. It's a little bit akin to the smoking. You know, this is going to kill you if you don't stop, but, you know, they still don't stop. But for many of them, the motivating factor is looking in the mirror. And they do have quality of life issues. They have poor self-esteem. They're depressed. They have social phobias. They don't interact. That impacts upon them as much more than their health issues. And I imagine for a young adolescent that perhaps the health issues are a bit esoteric, and maybe these other factors are more important. So focusing on being healthy may not achieve much behaviour change, but I'm putting that question to Matt. Will it? Won't it? I guess it depends on the individual.
No, I think you're right. And I think parents of young children understand the potential metabolic complications. And I think adults, as they get older, and Joe and I were talking about this before, as they get older, have more of an understanding about metabolic complications. But teenagers really aren't too bothered about diabetes and heart disease. You're pretty invincible at that sort of age. And so I'd be looking towards thinking about psychological factors and self-esteem and those sort of parameters. My experience, however, is that some of these teenagers are so withdrawn when you see them in clinic that it's really difficult to get to the bottom of deciding, would you be doing them a favour by embarking upon a road of really intensive weight management, or actually would you be making things worse?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. We've got a question up here. Is there any country doing a better job than others at controlling obesity rates?
You're the one.
There are two or three. Japan women, that is adult women, are getting slightly thinner. And in Japan, they say that their school children, late pre-adolescent, early teens, are no longer getting fatter. And they've done that through an education campaign. In Singapore, school children are about 4% reduction in the proportion of overweight and obesity, which they did by two methods, a rather draconian, was going to be called a fat club, fat, fit and trim, but they turned it around to TAF club at school, and by changing their BMI for age charts. So they managed, because the kids in Singapore grew 8 centimetres between, so the average height went up 8 centimetres between the 1970s and the 1990s. So they had a thing. So they're two countries. And there is the suggestion in Australia that perhaps particularly our girls, so in the 12 to 16, may be flattening off in the growth. So they're still running around 22-23% overweight and obese, but the increase that we've seen may be flattening off, and we hope that that's so.
So are we doing better than
No, we're doing better than the UK, and we're doing better than many other places, and we're doing much better than New Zealand.
Can I just add something to that?
Yeah.
The Singapore program I certainly wouldn't be recommending, because in the long term their eating disorder rates have gone up dramatically for those children who were actually in that program. It was not a very good example of a public health program.
Draconian. That can only be done
absolutely
in Singapore.
So it may have worked in terms of reducing fat, but it also drove up eating disorder.
And in Singapore, the other thing they did was that, the 16 to 18-year-old boys, because you have to go in the army at 18, they actually lose weight, because if you don't meet the weight standards when you're drafted in the army, you certainly go in the army, but your 2 years doesn't start until you meet their weight standards. So that was an extra 5 months in the army. And then they've gone back to those guys, and 5 years after they left the army, even though they have to go back in every year for a period, they've put their back to their initial 18-year-old weight, having lost it. So, yeah.
I don't have any hard evidence about this, but I'd also be a little bit concerned about being optimistic about the statistics for 12 to 16-year-old women, because they might also reflect increased incidences of eating disorders. So we might be seeing people at both ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, we're trying to look at that, I think, in the next survey. Right. Now, one more question and then I'm going to wrap it up, because you've all been a wonderful audience of sitting here and listening to people, and we've been going for about 3/4 of an hour. So we'll bring in, yes, question, and then I've got a final question for each of you, which is brief.
About 10 years ago, a physiotherapist and nurse/diabetes education
Come on, don't just sit there. Joe?
No.
Cameron?
I think absolutely. I think this problem is so widespread. We're talking, you know, more than half of our adults are overweight or obese, and the rates in children from my adolescent studies, it's around one in three now. And I would definitely say that we can't rely on the medical profession to treat this. There are just too many people affected, and it is going to take a very broad-based approach that's across everything, community, schools, everyone, if we're going to turn this around.
Having the community involved is really important because it actually is effective. All right, now the final question is,
just one point. You mentioned that in that gap between the physiotherapist leaving their position and somebody else taking that over, that some people were lost to follow-up with who didn't continue the walking or didn't seek out groups. I think that's really important once people have lost weight, is that we keep following them up, because what we find is that people who lose weight successfully, they regain it. And what we need to do, and what we do in our Austin Health group program, which I'm involved in with an exercise physiologist, is we have ongoing follow-up, and that's really important so that they're not lost.
I think with the current Commonwealth funding, which is coming to states, there is money not to start new programs, but to evaluate and assess those that are there, which are effective or not. So there is an opportunity in the next 5 years to get some money for that. Can I just ask everyone on the panel, just obesity is a problem. We don't or can't treat it well because of the, you know, a whole range of factors from cost to individual. If you had your wish list, what do you think either the next step in obesity treatment or prevention should be? Is there a new treatment? Is there a new prevention initiative we should be doing? Starting from this end, so then you're next, Mark.
I'm a big fan of mindful eating approaches, which is about becoming more aware and eating mindfully rather than mindlessly. And I think there's a bit of promise in that. So for people who are interested, if you Google mindful eating, you get some interesting articles on the internet, and I think there's a bit of promise in that research.
Thank you.
In 1937... the university established the first tertiary program in physical education, and the rationale that was espoused by the inaugural director was because of the important relations between physical education and preventive medicine. So I would argue that we need to re-educate our children about the benefits of being active and eating appropriately, so that those habits that they acquire, they can carry with them into adult life.
Sure. Yeah, I would say, and I'm thinking about this more from an adolescent perspective because that's my area, I think that we really need to look about teaching young people to value themselves as individuals and to focus on that and not get too sidetracked by the pushes to be unrealistically thin and all of these sorts of things that lead to the yo-yo dieting that's happening, which actually does lead to, they're more likely to actually establish higher weights when they do that sort of thing in adolescence. So it's about focusing on being healthy and getting a better sense of self.
Cameron.
Nutrition's very complex, and I think that as dietitians we've also made nutrition even more complex and some of our messages. And I think some of the mindfulness or the actually getting into to real food and enjoying food rather than looking at nutrients individually. So things like Stephanie Alexander with the garden kitchens and Jamie Oliver and people who are passionate about food, and it changes the paradox on counting calories and adding up Weight Watcher points. And if you look at, say, cultures like the French who really enjoy their food, who are passionate about their food, and they're not counting the calories, they're looking at good, solid nutrition, which they enjoy and they enjoy smaller amounts of, rather than limiting or counting calories, and they really enjoy their food. And I think that changing that mental shift is going to be a big change for children and also for adults.
Joe.
I believe that most obesity is epigenetic, and therefore I think the most urgent thing is to find the causes and then to remove them.
I guess I expressed my views on the environmental change earlier, but I think right now we have a major health crisis, and that needs to be dealt with, and it needs to be dealt with in the most effective manner possible. And I think we need more public funding and access to surgery and multidisciplinary clinics to manage the current crisis.
Matt?
I think we should get away from thinking about obesity as the problem and start thinking about prediction models for disease. If you're overweight and happy and healthy, does it really matter? Should we be spending so much resources and effort and intense research to help these people who don't actually need any help? But if we can identify people who are at high risk of disease, low self-esteem, psychological problems, physical problems, and actually start talking about things in terms of health and well-being, then I think we'll move away from what has been over the last 20 years a lot of almost pejorative talk about obesity, and I think that would be very beneficial for medicine and for the society, actually.
Thank you. Thank you, panel. Joe, were you going to come and close the evening for us? Sir?
Well, first of all, thank you to the audience for coming. We're glad you're here, and I'd like to thank in particular Professor Caterson, who's come down from Sydney, who's been with us all day and who helped us launch the Obesity Consortium. And thank you, Ian. And I'd like to thank all of the speakers at today's scientific meetings. I think it's been a terrific day, and we hope that the consortium will have some impact on this epidemic, both in terms of the research that we will do as a university, but also in the collaboration that we will have with the other institutes that I mentioned before. Thank you. Thank you for coming.